The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chah. On this week's podcast, could extreme cooling bring people back from the dead? How hypothermia might end up being useful in treating intensive care patients? The Guardian's John Henley meets real-life crime scene investigators who are solving murders in the UK by studying insects. Plus, why did humans develop rhythm and music? And why does the Pope's astronomer want to baptize aliens? This is a cryogenically frozen edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. We're joined in the pod today by the busiest person at The Guardian, Nell Bowes. Hi, Nell.
Hello.
Also, a big hello to Kevin Fong, who's a consultant anaesthetist at University College London Hospital. Kevin's a stalwart of this programme and is usually here to talk about astronauts or space medicine. Today, though, he's going to be talking about something much closer to his real daytime job. Welcome to the podcast, Kevin.
Thank you.
Kevin's just made a TV documentary, Horizon, for the BBC, all about the use of extreme cooling in hospitals throughout the world. Kevin, just before we talk about how, you know, lowering body temperatures can be useful to doctors, what is it about intensive care that makes it so hard for you to treat patients?
Critical illness and resuscitation medicine have appalling outcomes. Of the many thousands of people who undergo cardiac arrest, for whatever reason, only a tiny percentage ever survive to go back to normal, productive lives. So anything that can give you an edge in that situation, and it's one of the very few situations in medicine, you know, when people are literally about to die, where you're really up against the ticking clock. Anything that can give you an edge has got to be worth exploring.
So something that will give you a bit more time to do that surgery or work out what's wrong.
Yeah, and it's not just a bit more time. I mean, the concept of using the cold to try and buy you time is not that new. We've been doing it in cardiothoracic surgery for a few decades. But more recently, we've been trying to see if we can use it in other frontline medical situations.
Just to reiterate that, the idea is it's about lowering the temperature of a patient in an attempt to try and give you that sort of edge. You say it's been used before. What's the sort of latest development in this?
We see a few people who are using this in the programme. The thing that really grabbed my attention was a guy called Hassan Alam in Boston, who's using it in trauma. And so in the United States, the epidemiology of trauma, you know, the number of people, young people getting shot, it's a tragedy, you know. You've got young people just systematically destroying themselves with handguns. And when you have that, when you have a young person shot in the chest with a very complicated injury, you've got a very, very short period of time to repair it before they bleed out and they die. Before, for those people, it was almost an irretrievable situation. Now, he's talking about getting these people in through the door, opening their chests up, cooling them down to less than half of their body temperature, and using that extra time to repair and revive them.
So tell us what happens to the body. What's going on inside when you cool someone down?
We're not made to survive at much less than our core set body temperature of 37 degrees Celsius, roughly. In the programme, very nicely, they dunk me in a tank at 12 degrees, and I feel really pretty unpleasant at just 1 degree below that. And yet we're talking about dropping people down to less than half, at 18 degrees. In the case of Hassan Alam, 10 degrees. And that plays havoc with your cardiac system. At about 10 degrees below your core temperature, you're at risk of running a cardiac arrhythmia and just dying on the spot.
I'm interested in exactly how does cooling help? What does it slow down that means that you then have more time?
So at one level, it looks like cookery, you know, just cooling you down, slowing down the processes, and putting you in this kind of metabolic slow motion. And to a degree, that's what it is. It takes the moment of death and turns it from an event into a process, and one that stretches out from, instead of just a few minutes of anoxia, of lack of oxygen, to something you can survive for many, many minutes, you know, good fractions of an hour.
So it's talking about damage to the brain is slowed, or damage to other parts of the body. How does it work?
When we're talking about using it here, we're talking about it's all about the brain. That's what they all said, the researchers. It's all about the brain. Every death since the beginning of the time has been caused by lack of oxygen supply to the brain, sooner or later. That's what it is that kills
you. So you might have a heart attack, but it's the lack of oxygen.
It's
the
lack of oxygen
in the brain
that kills
problem.
You. Yeah, if you could keep your brain perfused with oxygen, everything that is you would be safe. So when you're cooling people down, that's what you're doing. You're trying to preserve the brain to stop irreversible damage happening while you can get the pump back working and back online. These are proper all up. There are very few things in medicine that are proper all up heroic interventions. This is one of them.
You're saying they were trying it out live now. I mean, how much is this a research project and how much is it actually going on in clinical situations?
So Hassan Alam's thing, when I first read about it, or at least the first time that the story was brought to me by the researchers at BBC, I said, you're crazy, or this guy is crazy, you know, but where was your source for this? National Enquirer? And then they chucked a couple of papers at me from, you know, Jay Trauma and all the rest of it. I thought, oh. So he's doing proper stuff. He's trialled this in animal models with pigs, and he's taken the pigs, he's injured them.
Shot them in the chest.
Or some equivalent injury mechanism, and allowed them to be bled out, cooled them down to 10 degrees Celsius, which is like, you know, less than a third of your, almost a quarter of your core body temperature, and then taken the hour that you have when the animal is essentially dead, to make a repair, to reperfuse the animal, and then to revive it, and with good results. Good enough that he's going to start doing it in real patients as soon as he can.
Kevin, tell us about Anna Bagenholm. This is an interesting person you met on your travels.
So she's the index case in this. This is a skier who was 29 years old. She was also a doctor with two other doctors skiing in Norway, and she crashes through the ice while skiing, gets stuck beneath a layer of ice, freezes to death. Now, her temperature drops by some 24 degrees. She gets down to 13 degrees Celsius, and she dies there. They're 250 miles away from the nearest hospital, and the helicopter is an hour's flying time from them. And at that point, you've got to figure, well, you're dead. The helicopter can't get here for an hour. You can't get to the hospital for 2 or 3 hours, and you have no heartbeat. And yet they carried on resuscitating her, because the old adage in medicine is nobody is dead until they're warm and dead.
Until
they're warm and dead. That's the adage. If someone has died of cold injury, you're meant to warm them up before you pronounce them dead, because it's extreme hypothermia and death can look very similar. But this girl, make no mistake, is dead. Her brain has got no electrical activity. Her heart is not beating. They're in the back of a helicopter 2 hours after
and
her heart's actually stopped doing cardiac compressions.
Pumping her chest and blowing through her lungs.
And you can't even begin to imagine what a scrabble that must have been. And they get to this hospital in Tromsø in Norway. And at that point, anywhere in this country would have said, let's just stop. This is ridiculous. It's 2 hours with no heartbeat. But they carried on. They smashed her onto a heart-lung bypass machine and warmed her up on that. About 3-4 hours later, they got their first evidence of a spontaneous heartbeat back. And miraculously, against all of the odds, this girl survived. And it's in the books, and we all talk about it. Everyone really knows this case one way or another. But you talk to her, and you meet her, and you think, it's unbelievable to see her.
Are there any long-term effects of the cold?
So we talk about downtime in cardiac arrest. When they come in through the door, we say, what's the downtime? And if anyone says they've been down for more than 10 minutes, you think your chances of success are pretty low. This is a girl whose downtime was at least 3 hours, maybe up to 5 hours. And you think there should be. This girl went back to work, is now a practicing doctor, has a little bit of motor function in her left hand that doesn't work now, but otherwise indistinguishable from you or I.
And has she been studied and studied and studied to try and work out if it's something about her or something about the situation? I mean, it could be a combination of things.
You can't study her as, you know, she's a single patient. But what I think her case did do was make us revisit our concept of life and death. And it makes you think of death not as an event, but as a process, and one that you might manipulate with the simple thing of temperature. And that's been mapped forward now to this exciting work with Hassan Alam. And it turns out that it isn't just cookery. It's not just slowing down metabolic processes. There's something else. There are some molecular switches that you seem to throw when you cool people down this low. Because Alam's team in Boston have shown that the pigs that he cools down, when you warm them back up, they still seem to keep some level of cellular protection, even once they're at normal temperature again. So there's something more subtle and more complicated going on, probably at the level of the mitochondria.
What did it feel like to go into that 12 degree C tank you mentioned?
Okay.
When you see the program, I think I look like a bit of a wimp, because, well, it's only in 1 degree. We're hearing about people who go down 20 degrees, but they dunk you in this tank at 12 degrees and they tell you not to move, not to do anything, not to swim off, not to jump out, and it hurts. And not only that, but you're sitting there and every fibre of your body says, get out, you idiot, get out the swimming pool, you're going to die if this carries on, and for the purpose of the experiment, you're not allowed to. And it's really hard not to get out.
Can you breathe?
If you get dunked in very cold water, you have this spontaneous and uncontrollable urge to hyperventilate. And in fact, you don't see it in the program, but I had a mouthpiece in measuring my tidal volumes. And I, for the first 60 seconds of it, I'm just breathing at some ridiculous rate. And that's partly why people drown when they go in the water in cold weather, because they have this uncontrollable urge to breathe. They're in the water and they take on loads of water. They stuck that thing in my mouth to measure my breathing. They also said partly because if they didn't have anything in your mouth, you'd tell them to let you out. And I did think if I didn't have this thing stuck in my mouth, I would be saying, get me out, please. and it, for about 90 seconds, it was hell.
And then what happened? Did you calm down? Did you just relax and think, I can deal with this?
Did you feel sleepy?
The discomfort of the initial shock reaction, and it is a shock reaction that you have. You know, my heart rate got up to about 150 beats per minute. You know, you're in fight or flight for all the way, and you're in flight, you want to get out. Yeah, your body is saying, do something, because if you cool at this rate and it continues, you're going to die. And that's the situation I was in that tank. Then after a while, you just acclimatize to it, and it's unpleasant, and you're shivering. You know, I couldn't recommend it as an experience, but it was suddenly somehow better.
This research is sort of a part of a long line of recent discoveries, isn't it, about the extremes that human bodies can actually go through. You advised on the Extreme Everest Challenge a few years ago, where these doctors went up to the top of Everest and did crazy tests on each other and went on exercise bikes and things. And their research is starting to be published in the last couple of years, and they found that, you know, you can reduce the blood oxygen level to really quite low levels, which normally you'd be dead at. I mean, it's an interesting sort of area of extreme physiology.
The extreme environment theme is very interesting, isn't it? Because our exploration of the physical extremes of this world is about half a century old. You know, we climbed Everest in the 50s. We started going to the moon in the 60s. High-altitude flying is about the same time. In addition, the extreme environment that is intensive care is about the same age. The Copenhagen polio epidemic in the 50s marks our first foray, really, into organised critical care. So this probing of the boundaries of the limits of life is a relatively new thing and interesting, because it takes our concept of what is and isn't survivable and it turns it on its head. And that's what this whole programme did for me, actually. It made me really, really alter my concept of life and death, I think.
Okay, well, Back from the Dead, the Horizon programme, is on BBC Two tonight, that's Monday, in the UK at 9 p.m. And Kevin's going to stay with us while we look at some of the news stories around this week. Everyone's brought a story with them today. Nell, what have you got for us?
I've just got the lovely dinosaur that we had this week, Cosmoceratops, found in Utah. A dinosaur with a 2-metre-wide head and 15 horns. And you look at the kind of the structure, the fossil, and it's absolutely extraordinary looking. And, you know, it's just a bit of fun, but I thought I'd bring it along to talk about.
There's two things which are amazing about this dinosaur. One, the name, Cosmoceratops. That's a great name. It's Cosmoceratops. And also,
yeah, the other one that they had was Utah Ceratops, which seemed a little bit less less glamorous.
Cosmo with a K as well, so definitely sort of old school. And also, it's blue. I mean, the artist had real fun with this. The artist's impressions are always quite amazing of these things. But this dinosaur is blue. Is it an impressive dinosaur, Kevin?
Yeah, I'm kind of struggling to... what does this head actually really look like when they dig it out? Did they just sort of find a lot of horns lying around in the sand and just stick them on the head? How complete was this skull?
It's extraordinarily, like, when you look at it, the piece together, there isn't that much left to the imagination. Like, the artist hasn't... He's added a bit of colour, but he hasn't added that much in terms of actual horns. You can see 13 horns around the crest and 2 horns over the eyebrow, plus, you know, a couple, you know, on the cheeks and various... The current speculation is that it's not necessarily in terms of practical terms of fighting or killing food. It's more in terms of display. So the way to think about it is more as a peacock's tail or as kind of stag antlers to head off conflict by aggressive display rather than actual weaponry as such.
And where was the fossil found?
So we found in Utah, in this incredible space, the Escalade is called, where they've found up to 12 new species recently. There's an incredible number of new species, which people are trying to work out whether these are possibly different dinosaurs in different stages of development, which is what has emerged before when people have looked at new species. But in this case, particularly in the case of Cosmoceratops, he's a one of a kind.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave the last word to one of our commenters on that piece, Stimpy Gato, who says, Cosmoceratops, methinks we have some paleontologists that were Seinfeld fans. Wacky head plume coincidence? I think not. It's good. Good point. Good point. Kev, why don't you tell us about your very serious science story that you've got to discuss? You're a serious man.
Well, no, I found a new science hero this week in the form of brother Guy Consul Magno, who's billed as the Pope's astronomers. In fact, he's only one of them, apparently. And this is a guy who, as well as being a Jesuit priest, is also an astronomer with a bachelor's out of MIT and a postdoc position there, and a PhD from Arizona. And I just loved it because it was the usual, you know, it came in the week that the Pope was visiting the UK, and he got a fairly robust interview, and he just seemed to bat it all away. And he seemed one of those rare things that we find in the religious community, which is an extremely rational guy who was able to put it all together in a way that I found completely acceptable.
You see, now you're a space fan. This man is a space scientist. He collects meteorites. He looks after the Pope's meteorite collection. Did you know the Pope had one, for a start?
I didn't actually know the Pope collected meteorites, or indeed that he had an astronomer. I mean, it's the stuff of a Dan Brown novel, I think.
And also that the Pope has something called the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which updates him regularly on the progress of science.
As I said, Dan Brown all the way, all of this.
And Stephen Hawking a member of it?
Stephen Hawking is a member of the Pontifical Academy
of
Sciences.
How did that work out?
I think he's just because the Pope thought, I'm kind of an important dude. I can call upon the finest minds in the world, like some sort of Simpsons episode, and they just appear out of the ground, probably.
But he had a great statement about the Stephen Hawking quote, you know, about the "I've done away with the need for God" type attitude.
Yeah, this was the recent sort of headlines on the front pages of newspapers that Stephen Hawking's new book does away for the need for God. Not that we didn't think that he didn't think that before.
And so, as far as I can tell, he gets pulsed with this question, Guy Consul Magno, and he says, "Stephen Hawking is a brilliant physicist, and when it comes to theology, I can say he's a brilliant physicist."
Nice response.
Fair comment, really.
It's a very, very good comment. He also said, Brother Guy also actually said, when questioned about whether there might be life elsewhere, he was very excited about the idea that there could be life elsewhere. He's a science fiction fan, so he likes that. He got into science, in fact, through science fiction. And then the question came along, well, if there is life elsewhere, would you let it into the Catholic Church? Would you baptize it? And he's happy. He said that any many tentacled thing out there, however many tentacles it has, is all part of God's plan, and he'd be happy to baptize it.
But actually, what he said when he was asked, would you baptize an alien? His actual very good response was, only if it asked me to. You know, he's not out there on cosmic conversion.
All right. Well, everything you want to know on those stories and more, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Programmes such as CSI and Bones are slick and impressive, but they've got nothing on the Natural History Museum in London. Last week, the museum threw open its doors for an evening so that members of the public could meet the scientists who work behind the scenes. The Guardian's John Henley took the opportunity to meet two of the forensic scientists who help police identify human remains.
There are two basic types of forensic scientists at the museum. The first are the forensic entomologists. Now, these are, as the name might suggest, specialising in insects, insect life. The head of research there, a chap called Martin Hall, what he essentially does is collect and examine the insect life that's found on a dead body. By analysing that, he can tell, not strictly speaking, when the body became a body, but at least when the first insects found the body. This is because, in Britain at least, I mean, the two insects that I suppose he's most interested in are both species of blowflies, known more commonly, I suppose, as the blue bottles and green bottles. They go through very well-defined developmental phases, four of them. First of all, the eggs, and then they grow into larvae, which we know better as maggots, which feed on the flesh. After a certain period of time, they will pupate, become pupae, and then eventually hatch into full-blown adult flies. There are a number of variables, basically. It depends on the temperature of the body and the ambient temperature at the scene of the crime. Depends on whether the body was in the open air or in a sealed room, whether it's wearing clothes. But if you basically know that a blue bottle, the eggs will be laid sometimes in high summer. You know, a blue bottle can smell death from 10 miles away, basically. The females will find a body within an hour, lay their eggs. The eggs may take 7 or 8 hours, rarely more than a day, to hatch, to become maggots. The maggots go through 3 separate, very distinct developmental phases. That can take maybe a week. They stay about another week as pupae before hatching. If you know that, and you can apply the kind of temperature and open air and what have you variables to a quite complex calculation, and using a lot of experience, obviously, then you can end up with a pretty precise time for when the flies will have found the body. But anyway, he was out there on Friday evening with, as I suppose as his prime exhibit, the first ever maggot that was used in a court of law to help convict a criminal. This was a very celebrated case in the 1930s involving a doctor, Buck Ruxton, who murdered his wife and their maid servant, dismembered the bodies and mutilated them, and drove about 70 different body parts they ended up in. He dumped them in a river in Scotland where they were found. The evidence of one of the first ever forensic entomologist was accepted in court as a very sound indication of when those bodies had been dumped there, which fitted in with Ruxton's known movement and helped to convict him. Another of the scientists who was there last week is the museum's forensic anthropologist, Heather Bonney, whereas Dr. Hall is more about establishing the when of death, Bonney is more about the who. She's called in to help identify a body which may otherwise be very difficult to identify because it's been dismembered or very badly burnt or is partially or wholly decomposed. So she basically deals with bones. And by measuring the bones, forensic anthropologists can really quite accurately say the sex of a skeleton, for example, the age. They can often come up with any signs of prior disease or previous trauma or whatever, and those kind of things, compared with dental and medical records, may help to identify a kind of a mystery body. Both the scientists I spoke to, Martin Hall and Heather Bonney, both used this word that, you know, that obviously that CSI and bones, and for example, glamorize their profession. The big difference really is that they're actually just a single, very discreet part of an investigation. They don't actually get to go out and interview people or follow up suspects or leads or whatever. They get their evidence, they analyse it, and they write a report which they may then present in court. Oh, and the other difference which Martin Hall would like to stress is that the one thing that CSI can never, ever do is give a good impression of the at times rather overpowering stench of the work.
That was The Guardian's John Henley there talking about his trip to the Natural History Museum. And finally, the British Science Festival turned up its usual interesting quota of stories earlier this month. Our top intern, Monica Desai, caught up with Jessica Gron, a research scientist at the Medical Research Council's Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit. Dr. Gron has been researching the neural mechanisms of rhythm processing. Monica started by asking her why humans develop rhythm and music.
This is an excellent question. It's one that we probably never will know the real answer to, but there's some really interesting ideas out there. One is that rhythm is something that promotes social bonding, so that by moving together and making music together, we often do move together, that this promotes pleasure in the brain and it bonds us socially to people, which could be really useful in a hunter-gatherer society where lots of rituals are combinations of music and dance, maybe around the fire in the evening, and that by bonding the groups together, they show better group cohesion for hunting or for maybe defending themselves from attacks from other tribes.
Not all of us have a sense of rhythm. Some of us find it a bit more difficult. We might describe ourselves as rhythmically challenged. So are we born with either having rhythm or not? And can we develop a sense of rhythm?
Yeah, this is something we're just beginning to look at. So there was a really interesting study a couple years ago now on newborn babies. These are babies who are 1 or 2 days old. They were able to record the baby's brain responses using electrodes, and they found that when they would put a gap in a rhythm, something that most of us would recognize as the rhythm going wrong, the baby's brains were sensitive to it. They changed their response to the gap. So it looks like it's something we are born with, but we don't really know if that means whether it's innate or not, because babies can actually hear in the womb from about 6 months. So 3 months before they're born, they're already getting musical and rhythmic input through the mother's body. Neuroscience still doesn't know a lot about what makes people have a good sense of rhythm or a poor sense of rhythm. We're looking at things like experience and training, but as you say, there's a lot of individual variability out there, and we're still not sure why that's the case.
In your talk, you also discuss how we might use our understanding of music and rhythm to help understand movement disorders. Can you expand on this?
Yeah, certainly. So this is something that comes from the finding that when we're listening to music, even if we're not actually moving, we get quite a lot of activity in areas of the brain traditionally associated with movement. These are the same areas of the brain that might be affected in certain disorders, for example, Parkinson's disease. So in Parkinson's disease, you have underactivity in a particular motor area of the brain called the basal ganglia, and this results in problems with movement, problems with starting movement, or sometimes with carrying on a continuous movement. So one idea has been to try to use music to boost activity in these areas that might have an impact on these people's ability to walk. So one of the things we're looking at now is it true that when you play music, this helps people walk better, particularly people with Parkinson's disease? And if so, does it matter what kind of music? Does it have to be walking speed? Does it have to be something they like? Does it have to be something familiar? And these are all outstanding questions that we're currently researching.
Jessica Gron there in conversation with Monica Desai at the British Science Festival in Birmingham. That's it from us this week. Thanks to Kevin Fong. Kevin's programme, Back from the Dead, is going to be on BBC Two on the 27th of September, and it'll also be on iPlayer if you've missed the initial showing. Thanks also to Nell Bowes. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, and remember to have a look at our shiny new science blogs too, guardian.co.uk/scienceblogs. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.